Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und mein heutiger Gast ist Ecet Temelkuran. Die international bekannte Autorin setzt sich intensiv mit den globalen Herausforderungen unserer Zeit auseinander, von der Erosion der Demokratie bis hin zum Aufstieg des Rechtspopulismus. Ihr Buch How to Lose a Country wurde weltweit ein Weckruf, die Mechanismen moderner autokratischer Bewegungen zu erkennen und zu bekämpfen. Ich habe sie im Rahmen der DLD-Conference in München getroffen und wollte von ihr wissen, wie die Wurzeln des aktuellen politischen Wandels zu verstehen sind, welche Rolle Deutschland im globalen Kampf gegen Rechtspopulismus spielen kann und warum der Schlüssel zur Verteidigung der Demokratie in Würde und Gleichheit liegt. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Ecet, I'm so happy to meet you here in Munich during DLD. I just told you I was very happy to see you on the speaker list, and I immediately reached out to you to arrange an interview. So already a while ago, I read your book, How to Lose a Country. And back then, the whole situation, especially in Germany and also in the US, wasn't as critical as it is today. So what would you say? What changed ever since you wrote and published that book?
Well, I have to disagree, because actually the situation was already very serious. That's why I wrote the book. In 2019, it was published in several languages, also in German and Dein Land nicht mehr dein Land ist, because I thought it was urgent. And I thought maybe if we could come together and talk about this seriously, take it seriously altogether, things could have been different. Unfortunately, that is not the case today. And in the book, and when I was talking about the book for in several countries, I always told that I trust Germans, because it will come to Germany as well, and then only Germans can stop this. Not only because of the obvious reasons of history, because they Germans have an experience about this, but also I trust the sense of law, very strong sense of law, very strong sense of institutions and democratic institutions. And I still am keeping that faith, to be honest, despite all the things that's happening in Germany today. What has changed since then? The particular change, the most important change, I think, when I published the book, I wanted to use fascism in the subtitle, Seven Steps from Democracy to Fascism. But every editor all around the world despised the idea, but especially Germans. They said, no, we cannot call this fascism. Fun fact, the other day when the book was republished in English, we changed the subtitle to fascism, and my German editor called me to say, you were right all along. I think there was a shyness, so to speak, a hesitation, and somehow people wished that it wouldn't happen, I think. That's why they didn't want to use the word fascism. But now I think it became incredibly popular after Trump's victory in the United States, and now everybody's using it. That is what has changed, I think.
So you already mentioned Trump. We also have AfD here in Germany. And we also see right-wing developments in other also European countries. We are looking to Italy, France, the UK. So it's Finland. There are so many right-wing developments in so many countries right now. But do you think was the initial kind of spark that established all of that? Is there something where you would say that could have been like the reason why, after everything we might have or could have learned from history, that we are going back now?
Unfortunately, it's not going back. It would be so easy if it was the exact repetition, if fascists today wore uniforms and military boots and funny mustaches, whereas they come like a circus, traveling circus to the political story. And what sparked this takes a book to explain. But then, very briefly, I think my analysis of the situation separates from the others there is that fascism was already embedded in neoliberal system. And what we are living today is actually thanks to what we have been through in the 1980s. It goes back to Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, when neoliberalism was unleashed on people with extreme greed and this sanctity of profit and business being irrelevant to politics and so on, or beyond and above politics. At the very heart of it, and I talked about this in Together, a manifesto against the heartless world, I think the biggest mistake was to break people's dignity in this, you know, incredibly unequal system. And when people's dignity are broken, and this is somehow repetition of the history, especially in Germany, when people's dignity is broken, 99% of the time, they go for their pride. And there's always some politician telling them that their pride is broken, and in order to mend it, they have to make some other groups of people kneel down. You know, there's economic reason, there is a political, emotional reason, and so many other reasons. But then I think what happened to the world after 1980s was that humanity's dignity was broken. And now we are suffering the consequences in the political realm, but also in moral realm, actually. So these politicians, half of the time, half of the things they say is not completely wrong. Yes, there are people who are left back, they are behind. Yes, there are people who are angry. And unfortunately, there's only far right that organize and mobilize this anger. And this anger is not completely irrelevant or like wrong in that sense, the anger among people. And of course, we can also go back to Cold War and how socialist, the left has been demonized. And when you demonize left, when you try to erase the left ideology from politics, of course, you end up with either center and right. And center then only go towards right, which is happening in every European country at the moment. The centrist politicians are, you know, trying to schmooze in with the right-wing politics. I think it is time we drop the fears of the Cold War, this, you know, demonization of left, because I think that is the only solution at the moment. To keep the balance of democracy, one has to protect the left as well. So, yeah, I didn't only talk about the initial spark, but I also talked about the solution, but it is very much all together on these topics, I think.
Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago, I did an interview with Ilko Sascha Kowalczuk, who is a Berlin-based historian and author. And we talked a lot about East Germany and everything and the reunion of Germany and why right-wing parties gained so much traction, especially in East Germany. And at some point in time, we came to discuss the question of how much freedom people are able to live with. If there is a certain amount of freedom in a society that leads to people asking for like a strong hand that takes over leadership and tells them what to do, what do you think? Is there like a level of freedom that is too much for a society, for democracy to withhold?
When you talk about these things, about these topics, and put freedom at the center, it always deceives you. It just is not right to look at this from the perspective of freedom. That's why I keep saying dignity, dignity. Speaking of East Germany, for instance, thanks to my fellowship at Robert Bosch Academy last year, I became quite familiar with the topic and the history of the topic. And I already knew about the harsh privatization of Eastern Germany and so on. And I remember this story from my days last year at the academy. When the wall came down, the Westerners went to East Germany to paint the walls of the East Germans. And when they didn't want this, the East Germans, they were so angry. And they thought that they are hated and so on and so forth. You know, a country is coming apart, identities come apart, and you want to paint colorful, you know, colors on it and so on. And the anger that comes through it, of course, can, you know, after decades, turn into somehow far right, because that is where the anger is organized. This is a, you know, very telling story, I think. But on the other hand, this freedom, and it's absolutely bizarre interpretations today by Elon Musk, by Zuckerberg, by several others, is so, I don't know, it's misleading. Yeah, that is the word. It is misleading. So I think we should steer the conversation towards dignity and equality. That is where the politics are happening. And speaking of freedom is always kind of somehow irrelevant, because not everybody needs that much of freedom, and you cannot, or they feel like they don't, and you cannot start the conversation by blaming them for not wanting more freedom. But everybody, we know that everybody, you know, is very protective of their dignity. Even when there is no freedom, they are protective of their dignity. And this is what we have to look at if we want to really solve the problem.
So we already briefly talked about Trump, and I also mentioned AFD. Do you think we can compare what is happening in the US with what is happening in Germany or in other European countries? Or would that be a mistake to just look at the US and with a whole maybe different economic situation, with a whole different social structure, and also maybe a bigger difference when it comes to income and wealth within the society, and then comparing that to Germany and say like, okay, we just have to look over there to see what is happening here or what is going to happen here?
People get really angry and tense when the others start to compare countries and so on. And there is this myth of every country is so specific, every country is so... Well, it is true. They are specific. But the problem is, it's not about the, you know, particularities of certain countries. It's about the political phenomenon. And it happens exactly the same way in each country. That's why I wrote How to Lose a Country, 7 Global Patterns of Rising Fascism. Because it doesn't matter if it's a crazy country, underdeveloped country like Turkey or America, so-called mature democracy, blah, blah, or superpower of the world. It happens exactly the same way. Even if it, you know, doesn't, you know, like, even if they are not identical, we have to see the patterns in order to create an international solidarity. One of the reasons I wrote that book was to show that there are these global patterns so that people can come together on a global level to stop the current. Because we know that right-wing leaders, far-right leaders, or leaders with fascist inclinations, they are already very much so in solidarity. They are cooperating. And we know that from several examples. So in order to beat this beast, this political and moral beast, I think we have to do the same. And imagining to beat this beast within the limits of nation state, every nation state, is just a dream. It cannot be realized. But then there is, of course, you know, when it comes into how to deal with it, how people, countries are dealing with it, there is, of course, certain differences. Although many things are the same, there are certain differences. For instance, American democracy or American government, current government, is trying to do more like, you know, surfacial fixes and trying to protect democracy from Trump. Whereas Germany, they are strengthening the constitution. They are somehow fortifying the institutions and so on. That's why I trust Germans. They know what they're doing. But then I think they're missing a point, which is politics of emotions. And this country needs more politics of emotions to stop fascism, because fascism, right-wing ideologies, today's far right, mostly depend on politics of emotions. They are not really, you know, proposing a program or anything, except for these outrageous things such as deportation and so on. They are running on emotions. And if we look down upon politics of emotions. If you talk about politics of emotions in a condescending way, which is very present in this country, there is no chance to convince those people who are going behind those leaders, IFD and Sefalad, IFD name. It is, to be honest, I'm personally, it is quite frightening for me, especially the latest news about these fake deportation tickets. I'm living in Charlottenburg, very close to Kudamm, and there's Walter Benjamin Platz, there's Otto Grotz Platz, you know, several platzes or streets named after those people who had to leave this country once. And sometimes, and also these artists, thinkers, and writers happen to be the ones that actually shaped my thinking in my very young age. So now I'm thinking, oh, actually, I am now sharing with them as, you know, reality. This is happening. This might happen to me as well, if I say the wrong things in the wrong time or the wrong place. So personally, it is quite depressing, to say the least.
So we already talked about it's not exactly the same as it has been like about 100 years ago, but I tend to simplify things sometimes a little bit to ask naive questions. But if we look, I just told you, we did a new podcast show on how Hitler gained power and how he overturned democracy back then. And if I look at similarities, I do see that back then, the country, Germany, became out of a war. We had an economic crisis. We had hyperinflation. We had a lot of fear within the society, within social structures about the future. They didn't know what is going to come. And if I look at where we are today, we are coming out of a pandemic with a lot of uncertainty. We do have an economic crisis. We do have inflation. And we do have a lot of uncertainty about the future because there's climate change, there is war, even in Europe, and people are afraid of what is coming next. What do you think? Is it too simple to compare that?
Not at all, not at all. I'm like, we should do these comparisons, not only to understand today, but to remember past correctly. And especially when it comes to how to prevent fascism taking over, I think we should remember that it required daily courage, you know, courage on daily basis, because when IFD will gain more power, the social life will change and things will get normal, more and more normal. And you'll see your friends actually saying, oh, it's not that bad. You know, these things, we have to remember the past as well. When it comes to remembering the past, we have to remember those like a little bit invisible things, because Hitler is a very visible, you know, symbol. But there's the other stuff, there's the other story that is less invisible, which legitimizes a fascist power. Anyway, the comparison is good. But then maybe we have to add this. Today's predicament is that neoliberalism, big capital, has become so incredibly, limitlessly powerful that it is swallowing up democracy. They do not need democracy. And that is why I am concerned, because I'm asking myself, how many of the businessmen or which government would say no to Elon Musk when he really comes with this massive amount of financial support? So I think what we are going to witness in the coming 5 years or so, whether democratic ideals of the Western world are strong enough against the greed of capitalist world, because this is what it is. Why did we end up here? Because capitalism has turned democracy into a theatrics of itself. People cannot change the economic system through vote, so they lost their faith in democracy. And understandably so, by the way. So that's why they don't want to protect democracy, because there is nothing good in it for them. They cannot change their basic precarity through democratic system. So why would they be passionate about democratic rights?
So we just had a conversation between Alice Weidel and Elon Musk last week. And she said a couple of things that reminded me of something I described as A-B testing with Donald Trump in the past, because he's trying to say things and he looks how people are reacting to it and if he went too far or he didn't. Mm-hmm. And then he's going the way that is the best for him. What Alice Weidel did last week is pretty similar. She said a lot of things also during their party assembly during the weekend. It was very clear to me when she said that Adolf Hitler was a left-wing communist, which is so bizarre that she can't be serious about that. But she is trying to say crazy stuff to make other things more or less sayable. What do you think about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, like one of the common patterns of fascism rising to power on a global level is to make outrageous statements so much so that you paralyze people's minds. And then all these people think like, how can she say that? And then you almost freeze in that moment. Like, how can she say that? How can she say that? And then seriously, then the conversation is dismantled. Because you cannot say anything against it because it's so stupid. Well, let's change that one. It is so absurd that you cannot even say anything. Actually, there's a funny conversation between Aristo and right-wing populist in How to Lose a Country. And right-wing populist drives Aristo crazy, which was to say that, the new kind of fascism directly targets the main pillars of logic, so that you become alienated as a normal person, normally functioning brain, you become alienated. The thing is, this Hitler being leftist, of course it is like laughable, but then it is rewriting of history. And what we find laughable is not laughable to many, many, many people. And this is the guy who holds one of the biggest social media companies in his head. So if he wants to rewrite history in such a way, what would stand against him? What is strong enough? Who is strong enough to stand against him? Because in this age, we know that truth does not matter, or facts do not matter, rather, and truth can be fabricated just in like blink of an eye. So he has the power to determine what truth is. This is the problem. It's not the problem that he's making these outrageous statements. The problem is that these outrageous statements can, in a minute, become the truth for big masses.
So we are right in the middle of this kind of a spiral of populism when it comes also to the elections in Germany. We do see that not only AfD is using populism strategies, but also other parties like CDU, CSU is tending to use more populism in their strategies. If we look at our latest history in Europe, we can see that fighting populism with populism is not very successful. If we look at Austria, for example, at the same time, fighting populism with populism seems to be so much easier because you can fight simple answers with other simple answers. If we try to fight populism with facts and more complex concepts, we do need so much more time and, on the other hand, so much more attention from our audience. So what is the solution there?
Of course, the solution goes back to dignity, equality, and so on. And what is popular and populist is two different things. If you say today that everybody will be equal, is it a populist thing or a popular? Well, it can be very, very popular if you really mean it and if you're going to fulfill your promise for a political party. I want, taxation on wealth, bigger taxes on, bigger capital. That's a very popular thing to say, but it's not populist. It is something that targets the inequality, which will make a lot of difference. And many people, bigger masses might go for it. But this doesn't mean that it is a populist thing. I think how to handle the situation on daily basis with far right is another matter. I mean, like that's about organizing, that is about, you know, creating new political narratives and so on. And when we speak of that, actually, we have to look at those masses who went onto the streets last year. Anti-fascist, anti-protests happened in this country on massive scale. It was amazing because I think it is because Germany became the first country that went onto the streets, not after a crazy leader took over, but before. That changes everything. But then these people who shouted against anti-racism and fascism, they do not have a political home. They are not convinced with the centrist social democratic politics. And unless they find a place, political home, things will get really, really difficult for this country. I think the political question today in Germany is who is going to organize those anti-racist, anti-fascist masses who do not have political affiliations.
I had a conversation with Philipp Bruch a couple of weeks ago. He is an activist and artist doing a lot of concept art against AfD, mainly over the last couple of years. And he's also the founder of the Center for Political Beauty, which is based in Berlin as well. And we talked a lot about that the election that is coming up isn't the one where we are actually fighting democracy, because AfD is going to be around maybe 20%, which is a nightmare, but it's not as dangerous as it could be in 2029 with the next election after that. And he kind of described it as some kind of last chance to fight for democracy over the next 4 years. What do you think? How serious is the situation in Germany? You said that Germans know what they are doing, but I'm, to be honest, not that sure about that.
Well, I'm saying these things not only because they are true, but also I want them to be true. I know too many people in this country not to believe in this country. And these people would give them everything to not to lose democracy. So with respect to them, I cannot say too many pessimistic things, to be honest. This is the first part. Secondly, I'm very interested in this political beauty thing, because for the last 2 years, I've been talking about political beauty, because how do you, at the very core of it, how do you fight fascism? By creating beauty, political, moral, aesthetic beauty. So I'll have to check out this artist for sure, back in Berlin. Yes, this is how you actually do. You create beauty. And beauty does not mean, you know, flowers, rainbows, unicorns. Beauty means being determined to stay moral. This is an easy thing to say, but it's not actually that easy to do when the power shifts from, you know, center to the right. Now, entire Germany is talking about this conversation between AfD leader and Elon Musk. Aren't we talking about this? Everybody's talking about this. So they don't have to have 30 or 33% like Hitler did once. They're already setting the agenda. They're already determining the narrative. They're already, you know, influencing, especially the Conservative Party and so on. And people like me, who look like me, are already uncomfortable. They feel vulnerable. And many people who were born in this country, but not blonde and so on, they feel like perhaps Germany will not be their home virus. That is tragic to begin with, but also it is terrifying. Because I'm living in a city, and several cities are like that. I'm living in a city where there are these stumbling stones. So one cannot comprehend repetition of history in that scale, in that way. It's incomprehensible. And I don't want to even understand it. Having said that, I think one of the tactics of right-wing populism, far right, is to shock you. And then by these shocking statements, shocking moves, actions, make you talk about them, but nothing else. So one of the things that people have to do, I think this goes for every country, but Germany as well, let's not talk about them. Let's talk about us. And let's not talk to them. Let's talk to each other. Because these shocks, especially in social life, in social media, in political life, and so on, these shocks become really paralyzing and they become dumbing. So we have to turn to each other rather than watch them with these wide eyes and getting shocked after shocked and so on. This is a very important thing that in many countries have been dismissed. We couldn't do it. And in Turkey as well, we couldn't do it for a decade or so. The only topic was, did you hear what they said? Did you see what he did? And so on. And then the human mind becomes blurry with these things. And then in the end, you become disabled in a way, politically, morally, socially. So yeah, I think we have to turn to each other.
So I'll give you one more of my naive, simplified thesis. If we look at Germany one more time, we have a very dark history when it comes to destroying democracy. We had Adolf Hitler and everything that happened with him. But after the war, let's say from the mid-60s to the 70s on, we tried to completely ban everything that was right-wing from our daily life, from politics, from everything. So we pretended that there is no right-wing party, there are no people that have like a more right-wing mindset. So we kind of tried to put it away and pretend that it is not there. And my point of view is that while doing that, we completely forgot how to actually fight it, because we just said it's not there. It was there, of course. Like in every country, there is no country, there's no society that doesn't have some kind of right-wing spectrum in their society. But by pretending that this will never be present again in this country, we completely forgot how to actually fight it. And now that it's kind of coming back in a different concept, with different faces, with different, maybe not that different ideas, to be honest, but with different ideas as well, we are not as good as fighting it as maybe other countries that always had some kind of right-wing spectrum in their daily lives, in their daily politics.
You are German, so you cannot say it, but I am not, so I can say it. This, making fascism a German brand was the most convenient thing for Europe after the Second World War, and it gave them the chance to forget about their fascists and their fascism. It was love to put it all on Germans. So let's not forget that fascism is not a German brand, not completely. One. Second, this country has been through a lot in 1950s, was the most interesting times, I think. And it was almost absurd, because this language is the language that the most important political texts against fascism have been written. This is the language that produced the, most prominent thinkers who wrote against fascism. And I never understood how Germans agreed somehow to take lessons of democracy from, some British or American soldier. So that is why I find that period very interesting. Of course, they were defeated, so the winners had to teach them what democracy was and so on and so forth. But then how did Germans really forget about their own people who wrote about this in the most profound way possible? We're still reading Hannah Arendt today. Why doesn't Germany read Hannah Arendt? They didn't read Hannah Arendt in 1960s because it was Cold War and because this and that. But then I think when we talk about remembering, we shouldn't talk about Hitler. We should talk about Walter Benjamin, Adorno, Hockenheimer, Hannah Arendt, and several others. They're amazing people there. There's an amazing literature. So what to do against fascism? I think Germans can teach the entire world if they read in their own language what has been written during the Second World War and after. So it is a pity for me to see this lack of remembrance in that sense. Yeah, I think, yeah, this is what I had to say.
Yeah, we do have so much knowledge in this country, but we are not using it. Or like, it's, I think it's even a bit more complex, because I think we do have a lot of people in this country that are very aware of what happened and how it happened, and do have deep knowledge. But at the same time, they are kind of living in their own bubble. And they are pretending that everyone else, or they are kind of thinking that everyone in the country has the same mindset as they have. And that's maybe the biggest problem, because those that are aware of what happened and what never should happen again and how it happened, and also see those similarities and the dangers in what is happening right now, are the ones that are way too quiet, because they think everyone else might have the same mindset and they are aware of the dangers and everything. But the truth is that bubble is way too small to kind of rule the public opinion all over Germany. So what we should try is to convince all those who know to be much more active and to fight for democracy in the end. Do you have, maybe as a last question, do you have an idea how we can convince those who know to act now?
Well, we're talking about decades-long demonization of left and progressive ideas. So it is not just completely surprising that these people feel like, okay, let's not talk about this. I'm like, the bubble, they didn't create the bubble. The bubble was created for them, because they were claimed defeated. It was the end of history. It was the end of ideologies. So at this 11th hour, when fascism is about to appear at the door, you cannot just tell them, hey, by the way, could you please come and help to save democracy? And which democracy, by the way? I mean, like, if there was a promise of real democracy with real equality, real dignity for all, then perhaps they might be willing to do it. But then, I come from a leftist family. My mother was in prison. My father rescued her from the prisons. Therefore, I am. So I know how generations, two generations of people were broken, not only physically, you know, exiled, tortured, imprisoned, killed, and so on, but also their heart were broken, because all these people in every country, from east to west, from north to south, in every country, there were two generations of people who were willing to sacrifice their everything for the good of the people. But they were, you know, seen as defeated people. They were seen as abundance, you know, irrelevant, and so on and so forth. So now you cannot just say, okay, come on, guys, we're doing this together. The promise. But then I know these people. I know I'm one of them. If there is a promise, a political promise, I think they would be, again, very much willing to be active, as you call it. And they are. I mean, like, they were on the streets during that time last year against AfD. The thing is, what happened after that? They were just thanked and they were sent back home, no? This is what I remember by the government.
Yeah.
It was just a thank you, bye. So this is not how you do politics, especially there is a danger when there is a danger of a real kind of fascism.
True. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Danny.
Your time.
It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.